TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. TUC Radio Archives. How Radiation Damages Life. Resisting the Building of New Nuclear Power Plants.
Fukushima Symposium 2013. Timothy Musso, Chernobyl, Fukushima, and Other Hot Places. Biological Implications. When the biologist Professor Tim Musso concluded the talk that you are about to hear by showing heartbreaking pictures of the birds of Chernobyl and their tumors and birth defects, the physician and anti-nuclear campaigner Dr. Helen Caldicott stepped up to the podium to thank him.
I want to pay homage to Tim Musso, who with his colleagues is actually endangering his life by going into extremely high radioactive areas, doing pioneering work, which is going to change the concept of radiation exposure to humans. What is happening to the animals, the insects, and the plants is going to happen to us.
Timothy Musso and his scientific collaborator Anders Møller from the University of Paris Sud have done research in the most contaminated areas of Chernobyl. When Fukushima Daiichi exploded, they began research there as well. They study birds, insects, microbes, and plants at over 1,000 sites, creating the most diligent inventories of each study area and returning year after year. They found significantly increased rates of genetic damage in direct proportion to the level of exposure to radioactive contaminants. Tim Musso spoke on March 11, 2013, on the second anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi explosions, at a symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine. The two-day meeting was organized by Dr. Helen Caldicott's foundation and co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. Musso is professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina.
Let me start by thanking Helen and Mally and the PSR for organizing and hosting this event. Surprisingly, well, maybe not surprisingly, this really is the biggest event of its sort, I think, around the world today. So count yourself lucky to be here. Anyway, I've been working in Chernobyl with my colleagues for about 13 years now. And a number of years ago, we started our work just by chance into the impacts of radioactive contaminants in Chernobyl. And it really was an interest driven by evolutionary genetics, evolutionary biology, not radioecology, not nuclear medicine, not anti-nuclear activism in any way. And we started our work with birds primarily because they're easy to see, they're easy to catch, they're easy to identify, they're easy to count. And some of them you can even track throughout their lifespan. And because they can't see, smell, or even heard about the radiation per se, they're not put off by the fence around Chernobyl. So they come in when they do. We can follow them. And we can track their lives in the very most highest contaminated areas. And this gives us a lot more resolution, a lot more power to conduct studies of the long-term health impacts, at least if you're a bird or a bug, of these contaminants. I'm going to start backwards in my talk. I'm going to start with the conclusions, and then we'll move backwards through some of the supporting information just for fun. And so the major findings, after working in Chernobyl since 2000 and in Fukushima since July of 2011, most organisms that have been looked at in any detail show significantly increased rates of genetic damage in direct proportion to the level of exposure to radioactive contaminants. We have a couple of papers on this topic. I'd be happy to point you to them. We've reviewed the literature, as have others, and it's overwhelming. Most organisms living in these areas show increased rates of deformities and developmental abnormalities. Some of them you might even call tumors and cancers, in direct proportion to the contamination levels that they're living in. Most of the organisms that we've looked at show reduced fertility rates. In terms of the male birds, about 40% of the male birds in the more contaminated parts of Chernobyl are completely sterile. They have no sperm. We've looked very hard, and 40% of the males have either no sperm or just a few dead sperm when we take the samples. Most of them that we've been able to measure have reduced lifespans. As a consequence of the reduced fertilities and reduced lifespans, many of these species have actually gone locally extinct in the more contaminated areas. So biodiversity has been affected. The last two points are a little more speculative, and they're a little bit more based on indirect evidence. They're hard to test directly, but I think our indirect evidence is pretty strong, especially now that we can compare the findings from Chernobyl to those that we're seeing in Fukushima, and we hope to compare Fukushima and Chernobyl to other naturally hot places around the world. The first is that it's very clear in Chernobyl. Ironically, because the radiation levels are so low, because they're low enough that organisms don't drop dead immediately as a result of exposure, they live long enough, some of them live long enough, to accumulate mutations and to pass them on to the next generation. And these will accumulate over multiple generations. This is our hypothesis. I think the data we have is strongly supportive of that. And we're not the first ones to suggest this, of course. The last point here, which is also equally interesting, I think, is that, again, because this isn't a black hole in its entirety, some of these individuals live long enough to migrate out of the area. The young of the year, some of them will migrate out, carrying the mutations that they've accumulated. So we see the effects of mutations in populations that have never seen radiation per se. And so I think, from my perspective, those as an evolutionary biologist, those are two important points. Most of our work has been done on animal models, and in some ways this has been good because it's allowed us to sort of pass through some of the gates and barriers that have been erected for people who study human populations. You know, if you're working on birds and bees, you don't get taken too seriously for the most part. So you can do things that other people can't do. But also, perhaps, birds don't drink or smoke or get depressed, as far as I can tell. For the most part, we don't have to worry about some of the environmental issues that have been suggested as important for some of the effects that we see in the human populations, alcoholism in particular, and drinking. And, you know, the sorts of questions we ask, again, as we're just biologists, so, you know, we ask, can we measure mutation rates in these natural populations? Does it relate to the radiation levels, contamination levels? Are there any consequences to the mutations? We all carry around lots of mutations inside our bodies. Most of them are never expressed. Most of them have no effect. Quite conceivably, the levels that we're talking about, maybe they induce extra mutations, but they don't matter because there are no expressed consequences. So we need to test for that. Are there deformities? Are there neurological developmental effects? These kinds of things. And finally, population sizes and ecosystem consequences. All right, so here's where we're a little different than most people. This is sort of the schematic of the approach that we've taken. It's kind of unique, and I really have to give a lot of credit to my collaborator Anders Mahler for really pushing this. You know, the natural world is a complicated, heterogeneous place, even in New York City. Every corner is a little bit different with respect to the amount of sunlight, the microtemperature, the amount of rainfall, the sorts of other plants that are there, the other bird species that might be flying in. Every point in space and time is unique. And so how do you factor out that variability to ask simply the simple question of, or not so simple question of, what is the effect of radioactivity or radioactive contaminants on an individual, a population, a species? And the way we've done this, got at this kind of question, is to employ what I call a massively replicated biotic inventory design. It's a long word. Basically, we go to as many places as we can squeeze into a short period of time, and we count every last organism that we see in these different locations. So in the case of Fukushima, we've made 700 of these inventories in the last 2 years. In the case of Chernobyl, we stopped at 896 because it takes a long time to do these things. But we go to a spot and we measure everything. The numbers of birds, the species of birds, the numbers of insects, the numbers of spiders, whatever is possible. And we also measure all of the particular, all of the environmental variables that might be of relevance in terms of determining the presence or absence and abundance of a given group of organisms. So the meteorology, the hydrology, the geology, the community of plants. Is there water around? What kind of plant species are there? That kind of thing. And then we, of course, measure the radiation level too, right? For the most part, we've used very simple measures of radiation level. And we've learned that that actually captures most of the heterogeneity in radiation just by using a simple Geiger counter. That's certainly a good proxy for most of the sorts of things that we're looking at as we've learned in the last year. We throw this into a GIS kind of model, geographic information system kind of model, employ some fancy multivariate statistics, but nothing so fancy that anyone in this room probably could learn to use them, to generate predictive models of radiation effects on populations. So when we do this, we can get at the partial effects of the radioactive contaminants on natural populations. It's worked pretty well. And so here you can see our areas of Belarus and Ukraine inside the exclusion zone, outside the exclusion zone, 896 surveys to date. Here's Japan, Fukushima. This is the general area that we've been to. Tokyo's down here, of course. Koriyama, 300,000 people. Fukushima City, 300,000 people. Here's the area of highest contamination. You'll note that we have not managed to get to this area here of highest contamination, despite our best efforts. Last summer, we did manage to get inside, you know, the 20-kilometer zone and to some areas that were on the order of 100 microsieverts per hour. So a good solid range. The trouble actually in Fukushima isn't finding hot spots. The trouble is finding cold spots to compare them to. And we have spent way more time looking for control areas with minimal contamination than we have looking for the hot areas. And I think that's informative. The first way we get this information is to do biotic inventories, where we just basically look and count everything. Another way is to set up nets for the birds. We set up about half a kilometer of nets, and we get blood samples, we get feather samples. We measure everything that's possible to be measured on a bird in a relatively short period of time. This is actually a lot of fun because we get to handle the birds. We also get sperm from the males if they have any. And we don't hurt the birds. We do release all the birds. We don't engage in destructive sampling at all. So how do we measure radiation? Well, we do it a number of ways. You know, in the good old days, we just took our Geiger counter. In the last few years, we've gotten a little more sophisticated, and we've taken our radionuclide identifier system into the field. And this will actually give us the radiation level, but it'll also tell us what's accounting for the radiation in the given areas, which is interesting. So this is a $15,000 Geiger counter, essentially, but very, very useful. Another way that we look at radiation dosage these days is we can take little TLDs. These are tiny little crystal chips that capture radiation that we can then return to the lab and read how much external radiation and what the external dose that this bird has actually gotten by taking this TLD, putting it on a bird band, putting it on the bird, releasing the bird, then recapturing the bird. We can get a pretty good idea of how much radiation they're actually getting. Anyway, and then the last way that we measure radiation actually is to take birds, put them in a special lead cave in the field without hurting them, and measure their whole body burden. And this has just given us a lot of information. And it turns out that we now know that there's actually a very good relationship between our simple Geiger counter measures of background radiation and the place that we catch the bird and how much radiation they're experiencing both externally and internally. All right, so undoubtedly a few of you in this room have heard these stories, right? The Chernobyl zone is this thriving Eden for wildlife. Who hasn't heard that story? It drives me crazy because it's been perpetuated by primarily a few journalists and a few unscrupulous sorts. And it probably is the result of this statement generated by the Chernobyl Forum a few years ago, who suggested that the populations of many plants and animals have expanded and the present environmental conditions have been a positive impact on the biota of the Chernobyl exclusion zone. And they've also suggested that most of the human morbidity is the result of stress, right? But the truth is, at the time this report was written, there were no studies of biodiversity and abundance in the Chernobyl zone. None. So how could they come to this conclusion in the absence of data? Well, of course, that's the way it's done, right? The absence of data is used to support the notion that there are no effects. So we decided to use that as our call to action, and we went out and started counting all the critters as we did. Yes, you will see the occasional animal inside the zone. Anyway, but we decided to test this more directly, because it actually doesn't matter if there are more animals inside the zone or not compared to outside. That avoids the main question. The main question is there an impact of the radioactive contaminants on these individuals and populations and species? That's the main question, not whether or not a fence keeps hunting out and allows some species to do better. So anyway, so we started counting them, and here's our first result. The abundance, the total numbers of birds, when you factor out all of these other things that can be that are associated with variation in bird numbers, and just look at the effects of radiation, there's only about a third as many birds as there should be in these radioactive areas, highly radioactive areas. And there's only half as many species because, again, some of the numbers are so low that they're not sustaining populations of a given species. So biodiversity is depressed by about half in these birds. When we first published this paper, some of the folks said, well, you know, birds, they're hypersensitive to everything. You know, the canaries in the coal mine, right? You know, you can't be thinking about just birds. And so we decided, okay, we'll do something else. And actually, so we started counting the insects. Sure enough, one of the most notable things is an absence of bumblebees in these most contaminated areas. And some of you have heard about the reports out of Japan, you know, mutant butterflies. It's true. You know, butterflies also appear to be hypersensitive to these contaminants. As a group, they seem to be much more sensitive than some of the other insect species. And very, very few butterflies in these most contaminated areas. Very few spiders. Many fewer grasshoppers. Many fewer dragonflies. But of course, then the response you get is, well, insects, who cares about insects? They're just bugs. What we care about are mammals, right? Because we're a mammal. And it took us a long time to figure out a way that we could sample the mammals, work with the mammals, because they're not easy to work with. They're smart, they tend to be nocturnal, many of them are subterranean, at least part of the time. You know, they're just hard to do basic science with. Then it dawned on us, let's go back in the winter and look at snow prints in the snow. Anybody know what this print is? It's a wolf, yeah. Yeah. So there are a few wolves in the Chernobyl zone, but mostly they're dogs. So we counted all the mammals and found the same basic relationship, many fewer mammals in the more contaminated areas. 2 years ago, we invited a group from Finland to come do some trapping, focusing on the small mammals. There have been a couple of folks in the U.S., for instance, who've been suggesting Musso and Mahler are wrong. We've been studying mammals, small mammals, for 15 years, and we see no effects. You know, there's no mutations, there's no effect on abundances. So we brought some independent folks who aren't connected with Department of Energy or any of these other organizations to trap the heck out of the mice, and we found the same basic pattern. Many fewer of these small rodents, big impacts on reproduction. So in fact, now when visitors come to the Chernobyl zone, you know, you've heard about all the tourism. The Ukrainian government has been trying to make money by busing in tourists to see the reactor. And of course, many of these tourists come because they've heard that there's a lot of wildlife that they can get pictures of. And of course, they come in and there's nothing to be seen. It's very, very rare to see anything of significance. And so they set up a petting zoo in the town of Chernobyl. So I think we've managed to convince a few people at least that actually Chernobyl is not this wildlife haven as suggested by the Chernobyl Forum. We've repeated this work in Fukushima, first in July 2011, then in July 2012, and as long as they allow us back into the country, we'll be back there in July 2013. Again, at 400 discrete locations to do our biotic inventories. We've also been working with barn swallows and barn swallow nests. What do we find? Well, with respect to the birds, we're finding the same basic overall pattern with respect to significantly reduced numbers of individuals in the more contaminated areas. It took us a couple of seasons to convince some of our local Japanese colleagues to really listen carefully, but it's a very silent place in most of these highly contaminated areas. Many fewer birds, many fewer insects, and it just smacks you in the face if you're paying attention. But anyway, strong effects. They're actually stronger in Fukushima. There were 14 species of birds where we could do direct comparisons between Chernobyl and Fukushima, and the relationship between radiation and abundance was twice as strong in Fukushima this first year as it is in Chernobyl, implying that perhaps there's a lack of resistance or there's an increased radio sensitivity in this naive population. Perhaps Chernobyl birds have evolved resistance to some degree, or just the ones that are susceptible have been weeded out already over the last 26 years. We don't really know the answer to that, but we're hoping to get to it. In Fukushima, the first year, we just basically saw, bird abundance and biodiversity. Butterflies were dramatically impacted, negatively impacted, as were cicadas, which aren't found in Chernobyl, so there's no comparison. But the other groups of insects were not negatively affected, as best we could tell. And spiders actually went up in numbers in the more contaminated areas. Anybody have any ideas why spiders might go up? Why would spiders go up? Excellent. Bioecology 101, that's great. There's no birds around. So, the main cause of spider mortality are birds. And so that's our suggestion. The second year, we've just finished the second year analysis, and it turns out that the effects are getting stronger. We'll see what happens this coming year. So we know that population effects are significant. Are there developmental abnormalities? We don't see any Godzillas or King Kongs, of course. But what we do see are very strangely anomalous organisms, including birds with very strange color patterns. So here's a barn swallow here. He's a partial albino. Here's a better view of the sorts of strange color patterns. Again, not enough to kill any bird, but... So we're starting to see some consequences potentially. We need to go back and verify that this is real. But we see all sorts of strange abnormalities, tumors on the beaks, strange growths on the beaks, strange missing patches of skin. Tumors around the eye are really quite common. Strange growths on their feet, tumors on their wings, strange growths around their rear ends. Just never been seen anywhere else in any great abundance, and they're much more common in areas of high contamination. Their brains are smaller. The neurological development's clearly impacted as a consequence of the contamination in direct proportion. And not only that, if they have smaller brains, they're much less likely to survive to the next year with these smaller brains. Here's a firebug. Somebody mentioned Cornelia Honegger, the Swiss artist who first started to document these abnormal insects around nuclear power plants in Europe. Here's the firebug, which is one of the bugs she first documented. And here is a collection of our Chernobyl firebugs. Very, very unusual patterns. Again, highly correlated to background radiation levels. We got a paper coming out in the next few weeks, maybe a month, showing that the birds in Chernobyl have much higher rates of cataracts. Again, another trait associated with ionizing radiation. So why has it been so easy for us to go in and document one response after the next? And the answer is, of course, that nobody has looked. Or if they've looked, they haven't followed through to compile the data and to analyze it properly and then to finally, you know, publish it. Why is that? Why haven't they done this? Vladimir, why haven't they done this? That's what I'm thinking. They don't want to know the answer to these questions. And so how are they avoiding finding the answers? They just don't pay for research in this area. They don't fund it, yeah. So with that, I think I will step down and pass the podium on. Thank you very much.
That was Timothy Mousseau, professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. He was recorded by Pacifica Radio at the 2013 Fukushima Symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine. The two-day event on March 11 and 12 was organized by the Helen Caldicott Foundation and co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. This is part 6 of a TUC Radio mini-series on the Fukushima Symposium, based on the testimony by scientists and researchers on nuclear construction and safety, the continuing emissions at Fukushima, and the effects of the spread of radiation across the globe. And in June of this year, 2024, Helen Caldicott reminded us of the research that was presented in 2013 and that you just heard. The opposition party in Australia had joined the campaigns in so-called advanced economies. They are claiming that switching from fossil fuels to renewables, such as solar and wind, makes it necessary to build new nuclear power plants. In the 11 years since he gave this talk, Timothy Mousseau has continued and expanded his research in Chernobyl and Fukushima. Ever since the dumping of radioactive wastewater from Fukushima began in August 2023, Mousseau appeared on panels of experts. They are explaining the effects of tritium, cesium, and strontium in that wastewater on life in the oceans and on land. Come back for more excerpts from Fukushima Symposium 2013 in TUC Radio's archives. On the second anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, an international panel of leading medical and biological scientists, nuclear engineers, and policy experts assembled at the prestigious New York Academy of Medicine. They discussed the medical implications of Fukushima and Chernobyl. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.